My background in this field is 10 years of work with abused and neglected children in the inner city area of Minneapolis. What I'd like to do during this 50-minute period is talk to you about some specific sexual abuse prevention ideas, because this is one area in the area of family violence where we as individuals can make a difference by educating other people. And then I'd like to show you a slideshow of our prevention and treatment program in Minneapolis, and then talk with you about any questions you have, get any reactions. I know that you're here because you have a strong interest, and some of you probably have some real expertise and experience in this area. Starting with sexual abuse prevention. 1 out of 4 girls and 1 in 8 boys are sexually abused in this country before the age of 18. Rape is the 3rd highest crime in many of our states, and 1/3 of the victims are children, 2 months to 12 years of age. The offender is usually someone known to the child, someone the child knows, likes, trusts, and who is often related to the child. The offense usually begins with unwanted hugs and kisses, and then progresses and increases in severity over time and often continues for years. Many children do not tell of the abuse. We can help protect young children by increasing our awareness of this problem and by educating them in an ongoing, casual, comfortable manner. Where to begin? At birth, we give children verbal and nonverbal messages about their bodies and about touch. The clearer we are about respecting children and their rights as people, the clearer messages we will give them about the right that they have to say no to unwanted touch and dangerous touch and touch that is not appropriate. Children need help in identifying these things for themselves. They need information about their bodies. They need the names of the parts of their bodies and what they do. They need a sense of what kind of touch are okay and who can touch them when and where. We need to know that their feelings about touch are going to change over time. We need to be in tune with their developmental stages. We need to be somewhat flexible in our demands and expectations of them, because sex abuse is likely to happen around their breaking a safety rule that you have already taught them. But a willingness to forgive them and not blame them anytime they come to you with a problem increases the likelihood of their coming to you and telling you about a problem with touch. If they can trust you to help them and not blame them, they're more likely to come and tell you about something like this. Okay. Children need to trust your unconditional support of them. Since much sexual abuse begins with unwanted affectionate touch, children particularly need permission to control the hugs, kisses, pats, and other friendly touch they receive from our families and friends. They need to know that adults are not always right or fair, and a bigger person does not have the right to take advantage of a child. Children must have the right to say no to adults and have a trusted adult that they can go to when they need clarification or help with a problem. Freedom from sex role stereotypes increases a child's safety from sexual abuse. Now, all of these topics can be taught and introduced gradually to infants, toddlers, preschoolers, and elementary school children. There are many approaches and opportunities to discuss this topic daily. It's a topic that needs to have the secrecy that shrouded it taken away. No one begins to do sexual abuse prevention like a pro. We all feel kind of uncomfortable because of our own upbringings, our own experiences. We feel awkward and nervous that we're going to say something that's going to make our children afraid, or we're going to say the wrong thing to them, to make them worry about something they don't need to worry about. But this leads to my favorite argument for starting real early to discuss this with our children. so that we adults can get over our nervousness and our fear around this topic before they become older and the questions get heavier. More importantly, with years of open communication comes the reassurance that our children will come to us with their big questions and that we will be honest with them. They'll know that we're going to be honest with them. We don't have to have all the answers, but we have to have the willingness to listen and to seek out resources when we need them. In spite of your efforts, sometimes rape and sexual abuse can't be prevented. In this event, what can be prevented is the undue trauma to the child, to the victim, and the parents. Know what to do if sexual abuse happens. When you learn about an assault, reassure the child that they've done the right thing in coming to you and telling you. You can assure them that they're safe and that you will protect them and that you will help them. Explain the plan. We'll need to see a doctor. We'll need to talk to a policeman so that they can find this person and keep the rest of the children in the community safe from this person. Continue to believe your child if the child has experienced sexual assault, and never blame the child. The blame belongs on the assailant, the perpetrator. The blame does not belong on the victim. Too often in our society, we blame the victim. It's the woman's fault that she's raped, you know, or the child's in the wrong place at the wrong time. But the blame does not belong on the victim at all, and they need to be reassured of this repeatedly. Instruct your child to tell you immediately if the offender attempts any sexual molestation again or bothers him or her in any way. Give your child reassurance and support that he or she is okay. Respond to questions or feeling that your child expresses about the molestation with a calm, matter-of-fact attitude, but do not pressure your child to talk about it. Respect the privacy of the child by not talking about it with other people, with too many other people, or with other members of the family, or in front of the child. Try to follow the regular routine. Inform brothers and sisters that this has happened, but that it's being taken care of. Okay. Take time to talk it over with someone you trust, your spouse, a friend, a pastor, a therapist, a counselor. Keep in mind that the reactions of the parents can cause further trauma to the child. Dealing with your feelings can help avert this. Some of you may be teachers or friends or neighbors, as well as parents. So I'd like to give you some of the behavioral indicators of children who have been sexually abused. The first one is unusual knowledge about sexual activity. This will come out in the child's play, in the child's interests, in the child's pictures. A child who is unusually seductive with classmates, teachers, and other adults is giving you clues. Refusal to dress for physical education. Some molested children think that other people know what has happened to them by seeing them undressed. Extreme fear of showers and restrooms, as these are common places for sexual abuse to occur. Frequent absences from school that are justified by one parent only, apparently without regard for the school's, for the child's school performance. This is of special concern if the child is home alone during the day with a father or a stepfather or an uncle or a babysitter. Repeated attempts to run away from home by a child who is otherwise not a behavior problem. A child who is unusually reluctant or fearful of going home after school. Some of the most common and immediate problems of sexually molested children are sleep disturbances, nightmares, fear of going to sleep, wanting the light on, waking during the night, fear of sleeping alone. Another one is loss of appetite. A third one is irritability, crankiness, and short-tempered behavior. A fourth one is bedwetting. Fifth is needing more reassurance than usual, clinging to a parent that they trust. Changes in behavior at school or in relating to friends. Fears, behaving as a younger child, regressing to a lower level of development. Now, these are normal signs of upset for many kinds of upset. Your child may have some of these problems or none at all. They'll usually last a couple of weeks. No one knows for sure about the long-term emotional effects of sexual abuse with children, but we think that if the situation is handled in a direct and sensitive way, as soon as it is revealed, your child is not going to suffer unnecessary trauma. There are lots of things that we as adults can do with children to give them the prevention skills. Some games that we can play that prevent the possibility of sexual abuse prevention. Any game or activity that increases self-concept, confidence, and encourages the child to be confident and assertive can be considered sexual abuse prevention. Practicing assertion creates probability of using it when you're in danger. Feeling good about themselves leaves children much less open to bribes or special attention or affection. Games about body parts and functions are real important. Early identification of each body part, playing the name game. You point to it and they name it. They point to it and you name it, including the genitals. Doing this at bath time, at dressing time, throughout the day. Giving the correct names of all the body parts. A child who is used to direct and open talk about their bodies is going to be suspicious if he's approached by someone who tries to be secretive. Touch. Use daily routine times when caring for our children to discuss touch. Help give them language to describe our actions and our involvement in the touch, such as, I'll hold you steady while you put your pants on. You smile when I hold you. You really like it, and I like it too. We empower children by giving them the words to describe the feelings and the actions that surround touch. Sometimes you may hear yourself insisting on something that you can be more flexible about. That's great. Acknowledge it. Put on your jeans. Oh, I guess you're okay. You can wear shorts. As they grow, they do more for themselves, and by verbalizing very early, we help them understand and become conscious and powerful about their bodies. We can assure them that they don't have to be affectionate with someone that they don't really feel like being affectionate with. And we will back them up. We need to be clear and help them understand what it is. Ask them questions like, what is it about Uncle Tom that you don't like? What can you do other than give him a kiss to say hello? Review lots of options. Okay. Avoid absolutes. Never say you should not. Help them arrive at solutions that feel good to them and to you. Do you want me to tell them that you don't like it? Do you want to tell them you don't like it? Can you run away before you get kissed too much? Practicing this throughout our daily experiences with children will give them the courage and the power to use that skill when the time comes. We model the behavior we want our children to use and to learn. Many of the sexually abused children that we work with will approach us inappropriately, putting their hands on our breasts or something, and a way to model to them that, I as a person have private parts, you as a person have private parts, I have a right to say, I don't want you to touch me there, touch me on my knee, or here's my hand. Give them some options. It can be especially helpful to children to hear the no unwanted touch rule from men, because 99% of the reported offenders are men. As children get older, frank discussions about what kinds of touch are okay and what kinds of touch are not okay can take place. There are lots of good resources for parents and teachers and grandparents to use with children. There's a wonderful one that's published by Lutheran Social Services of Washington. It's called My Very Own Book About Me, All Kids Are Super Kids. and it includes a child's book, a parent's guide, and a teacher's guide. The beautiful part about this resource, in my opinion, is that it presents touch and the children's bodies as beautiful parts of creation to be celebrated. You know? But it also gives them the information that they need about no unwanted touch. This is my body. I have my private parts. No one has the right to touch the parts that I don't want touched.
And one neat thing about this resource is we've got it in the school system in Spokane now. So the schools are open to it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Linda, would you give us the name of that again?
Yes, I will. And I've got a whole list here that I'll be happy to give you copies of. This particular one is my very own book about me, All Kids Are Super Kids, from Lutheran Social Services of Washington, from Spokane. Okay. There's another excellent resource that's come out of Minneapolis. It's called the Touch Continuum. The Illusion Theater and the District Attorney's Office cooperated with each other in developing a dramatic presentation of good touch and bad touch and different situations. And this has been presented to preschool age children and elementary school age children, and now they're working on one for secondary children. It's in picture form, so it can be used with discussion groups with children. It's also a dramatic presentation that kids can attend to and learn from. There is a movie of it now.
Is that on VCR?
I'm sure you can get it for VCR. But it's an excellent presentation. It involves the children. You know, it gives them examples of what situations are dangerous and which ones you can get away from and how. Okay, in giving the children a right to say no, just in life in general, find an area where they really do have a right to say no, whether it's about snacks or what clothes they wear or what park they want to go to, and then respect their ability to say no. Giving them the opportunity to practice saying no is an important part of teaching them to be confident people. We don't always have to accept their no's, but we can verbalize to them, no, I know you don't want this cookie, but it's not okay to mush it all over the car. No, you can still accept their feelings in a no response. Games to avoid. Okay, any activity that proves the adult's powerfulness and the child's powerlessness, okay, such as tickling a child beyond the child's comfort level, or the I'm going to get you kind of play. A much better option is to reverse the roles. And an example is when the child can face an adult and blow into the adult's face and cause the adult to fall down. You know, it's giving the child a sense of being powerful in the game. And you can reverse those roles. Children really enjoy being the powerful person who sets the limits in a game. With older children who can talk, what-if games, like, what would you do if somebody asked you to get into the car? What would you do if somebody said they'd take you to the store and give you a treat? What would you do if Uncle Tom said he wanted a treat then? Would you agree? What if he said, pull down your pants? What if he said, come into the bushes with me? Help your children to see the reasons behind the safety rules, the facts about what could happen. Help them to feel confident of their rights and the need to rely on their instincts. When do they identify potential danger? When would they act on it? How would they act? Do you feel good about it? Help them create options that are suitable to them and to you. Emphasize the importance of acting fast, getting away, telling someone, and it's never your fault if something like this happens to you. Another skill that's important in this area is teaching children to be good witnesses. Help children use their memory to describe people, cars, events, ages, sequences, scenes, and behaviors. This skill is often lacking in victims, primarily because no focus has ever been put on recall in crises. Play games around memory. Tell me 5 things about the man that's coming toward us. Can you describe the gas station attendant? Attendant who just helped us. What did the Robinson's house look like? What happened in the movie after Darth Vader saw Luke? Encourage children to concentrate and look inside with their mind to see if they can remember more. They usually can. This is the kind of information that should be shared with your friends and your loved ones, with your community members, with your church members, because educating the community helps confront the problem. In our treatment program in Minneapolis, we're working with children who are 0 to 6 and their parents. It's called a nurturing center, and we're looking at therapeutic nurturing, offering a security-giving relationship, which both the parent and the child may have missed, caring, respecting, and building trust. We're providing an identification model for interpersonal relationships and also for affirming and accepting oneself. We're teaching our client families good skills for coping with daily living. Our goal with them is to help them become competent and autonomous and feel the total range of feelings and be there with all the potential for human experiences. Many times people who have experienced abuse in their upbringing and in their family sort of shut down and they're not open to feeling what it feels like to be alive. We're looking at these critical human needs when we're dealing with victims of child abuse and neglect. The need for relationship. Each child needs to feel wanted and loved as a person in his or her own right. The need for touching and holding is a lifelong need. One of the things that we do with the children who are referred to us is give them permission to let us know when it's okay for us to touch them. If they don't want to sit on laps, that's fine. You know, we wait until they feel trusting enough to come and ask for physical touch. We don't give it to them until they're ready for it. The children and the parents who are referred to us have the need for identification. We as nurturers need to let children know how we function on the inside. We need to share our feelings and hopes and dreams with them. They need to be an individual to be different from. They need to nurture and give to other people, and they have a strong need for affirmation, recognition, and validation. Many of them feel like failures. They feel there's something wrong with them. This is especially true in the parents who are referred to us because they've been involved in child abuse and neglect. And a point that is real important to me in our work with abusive families is that the people that we're working with, you know, are not qualitatively different from anybody else. The potential for physically or emotionally abusing or neglecting children exists in each of us. Whether or not we can cope with the demands of parenting and being positive role models for children depends an awful lot on the positive nurturing relationships that we had as children. It's an intergenerational repeating cycle of learned behavior, and it has to be broken. You know, the children need to have all of these critical human needs met if they're going to be able to grow up and be able to nurture their own children. And in order for those children to have their needs met, we need to work with their parents.
Are you saying that you're working with the perpetrator as well as the mother?
Yeah.
And child? Now, is this before, after, or during adjudication?
This is... most of the children who are referred to us because of sexual abuse are referred to us because there's a potential for sexual abuse. There's a great suspicion for sexual abuse. Somebody such as a public health nurse or a doctor or a social worker has observed this child in some questionable play, and they will refer them to our center for us to further observe them and work with them.
The family?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is that voluntary participation?
Sometimes it's voluntary and sometimes it's not. Sometimes it depends on the child protection caseworker, and it also depends upon the family. Some of the families are court-ordered to us. Some of the families are given the ultimatum. If you do not participate in a parenting program, in a nurturing program, in a therapeutic program, your children are going to go to foster care.
But there's not necessarily prosecution or any kind of criminal sentence or anything to the perpetrator?
No, not at this point. Not at this point.
Does that make a difference in treatment?
In all of the treatment that I know with sexual perpetrators, prosecution is necessary.
But you're treating perpetrators where there isn't prosecution.
We're treating the family situation, yeah.
Doesn't that weaken your impact, your leverage?
It does, yes. But there, the court has not decided that this particular person has actually perpetrated sexual abuse when we see the families.
Well, do you get admission to abuse during the course of your program, or aren't you seeking that, or what?
Sometimes we're seeking that, and sometimes we get it, yes. And then the perpetrator or the child would be removed from that situation, and the perpetrator would be criminally prosecuted and put into a treatment program for sexual abuse perpetrators.
Would you continue with the child and the mother then,
yes,
without the father?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm just going to go over this chart. This is pertaining primarily to physical abuse and emotional abuse rather than sexual abuse. And we're looking at a continuum of behavior. Parenting is a very, very stressful, demanding occupation, as anybody who's worked with young children knows. And most parents on a good day can see the normal needs of their children as normal needs. But maybe on a bad day, those normal needs can seem kind of demanding to me as an individual who's tired and wants some time for myself. A child's repeated request for something can seem to me demanding. With abusive parents, the normal needs are more likely to be seen as demands. And on a bad day, they're going to be seen as manipulations. This child is trying to prevent me from having any time to myself by just asking for a drink of water or asking for having stories read. They'll see the child is trying to manipulate them into doing something that they don't want to do. But with severely abusive parents, they see their children's needs as manipulations and, on really bad days, as assaults. Severely abusive parents were probably severely abused as children. They didn't have these critical human needs met. And they see themselves as defective, shame-based people. They feel that a request or a critical comment about me is really a statement that I am a defective person. Whereas somebody who was lucky enough to have some really good, strong parenting can see that criticism as criticism. No, it may be valid, it may be invalid. Even if it's valid, I can go on from there. No, I'm not shattered by that. No, it can help me change my behavior in some ways. But the severely abusive parents are really seeing that as a threat, as an assault. And it's very, very difficult to work with people who didn't have these critical human needs met as children. Almost have to reparent them.
What percentage of the parents who were abusive actually had good parents? Somehow the situation rather become abusive.
I can speak from my experience, and my experience is that all of the parents who are referred to us were abused or neglected as children. Not all people who are abused and neglect these children grow up to abuse and neglect their children.
Linda, how often does alcoholism play into this?
Alcoholism is an important factor. It's a whole complicated pattern of dysfunctional behavior. And alcoholism is one of the related stress factors. Poverty is another related stress factor in the people we're seeing. But child abuse occurs across all economic levels. when a family is referred to us and there's chemical dependency, you know, it's necessary for the chemical dependency to be treated before the family functioning can improve mm-hmm. in terms of abuse and neglectful behavior by parents. I'm going to put the slideshow on, I think. And then if you have some questions after that, I'll try to answer them. Okay, I appreciate your interest. And if you do want the bibliography, I'll make copies of it. And I'm happy to make copies of this information if you want to take it back to people you work with. Because I think it's the kind of information that's going to help, because it can prevent it where it starts. It's really hard to deal with after it's taken place, you know, for generations or for a long period of time. But prevention, I think, is the key.
So,
yes, we do that when we're asked. We've done it particularly in preschools. The public school program in Minneapolis has people who come in and talk to the children from the sexual assault unit and from the Illusion Theater. It's the kind of information that just has to be general information, just like any other part of the curriculum. Not treated as something scary and secret, the better chance the children are going to be safe.
Well, we've used in our confirmation program some excellent films that are out for like junior high age kids, where they have a situation, you stop the film and then you ask the kids, what do you do? And then the film picks up with several alternatives. But the kids really get into that. Dealing with sex.
Do you know the name of?
I can't remember now. But there were two of them we used just this last spring that we got through the Living Social Service.
Mm-hmm. Is your treatment for adults much like your prevention program? Do you help them verbalize their feelings or their children
and their feelings?
We see oftentimes we're the first agency that these parents develop a trusting relationship with. And we see that as a real important part of our work. And then when the parent is at the stage of being able to really deal with the abuse that they've experienced, you know, they're being an incest victim or they're being a battered woman, we will refer them for individual therapy to a therapist that we trust. They continue with us in terms of parenting and the child's needs.
How are you funded?
We're funded, a third of it is Hennepin County Purchase of Service money, that's Title 20 Special Needs money from the federal government. And then we have United Way money that we got a couple years ago for the first time. And the rest of it we raise with foundations, corporations, churches, individual donations. We have a person on the staff, the financial administrator who does the fundraising.
How many children do you serve and what's your staff to child ratio?
We serve about 30 families at a time. The children are in the nurturing center in groups of 12 or 13. And in that group there will be four or five adults. This includes a person who's in charge of that group and a couple of assistants, a couple of foster grandparents, and then interns from the social work departments at the colleges in the community.
Do you have a problem with follow-through with families?
We got a $20,000 grant last year to do a follow-up study, and we are now trying to locate and interview all of the families who've been through the program.
up until this point, the follow-up has been informal. You know, they're coming back for support or just to check in, or some other social service agency calling us for some information, or the school is calling and asking about a child. But now with the follow-up study, we're doing pretty well. And it's been really encouraging because they're developing a questionnaire. The people who are doing the research are developing a questionnaire based on the family stories of how they deal with situations in their real life experiences. And then we're asking those same questions to the new families who are coming in to start in the program. And the hopeful and affirming thing that we've heard is that even though the families who've been through the program still have lots of chronic problems in their lives, they have more of a sense of being in control, more of a sense of able to cope and to go to resources and ask for help when necessary. Whereas the new families coming in have this overwhelmed, hopeless, helpless, what do I do? Kind of stance.
How can we get a copy of your bibliography?
I will go over to the Xerox machine when there's somebody there who will rent it for me and make some copies, and maybe I'll have it available at meal time.
Okay. Sometime tomorrow?
Yeah, sometime tomorrow. I'll have it at lunchtime. Okay, and I'll tell Elmer or whoever, we have lunch tomorrow in the dining room. I'll just tell them that people who want a copy of the bibliography should come. How many of you would like one so that I don't make too many copies? Okay. Okay.
Linda?
Uh-huh.
King County Ray Crisis has a book called He Told Me Not to Tell, that for people in the Seattle area.
Yeah, I've read that one and I've used it. And a friend of mine who's a therapist really likes it too.
The library in Longview has posters up all around the children's library about various things,
mm-hmm.
like told them not to tell.
Yeah.
Is it your experience that preteens and teens will come to somebody and say, look, I need some help?
Some of them do and some of them don't. Sort of depends upon how frightened they are and how powerless they feel.
Because you might feel that the child would know if they could go to certain people or
mm-hmm.
to their teachers,
mm-hmm.
and yet they haven't. And when you find out about it, you wonder, well, how you could have changed.
Yeah, that's why we want to start real, real young, real, real early. In Minnesota and Minneapolis, they had a huge campaign this spring over the major TV station on sexual abuse. And they had a crisis hotline available during the 2 weeks that this was on TV. Every night they did a presentation of some aspect of sexual abuse. And the calls were monumental. But they get calls from kids who said, you know, my dad is raping me. And that was the point that they couldn't go on from. You know, they weren't willing to identify themselves.
I heard on talk shows, especially at night, San Francisco also, and the first thing the little girls would say, am I wrong? Is it my fault?
Mm-hmm.
And then they begin to pour out their story. And through that program, there were quite a few who were helped, who were found, and taken out of situations and helped.
Right. I think we're doing more and more of that around the country, and that's a hopeful.
When you think of a little child, you know, 8 years old, picking up the phone and maybe doing it in another room from where the parents are and saying, look, I'm scared.
Mm-hmm.
That takes a lot of courage.
It takes an awful lot of courage. It takes a self-confident child who has the ability to realize what's good for himself or herself.
So maybe if you start with that, it was...
Very tiny ones, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.